I'm talking to my cousin, James Kuffner, who has a PhD in robotics from Stanford and who was one of the founding members of the team that developed the driverless car at Google. So James, let's talk a little bit about how you got started with that. What you were at Carnegie Mellon and developed some of the early technology on that as part of a competition. Tell me a little bit about that history.
So my role in particular was in developing the planning software, and the driverless car technology really got a boost in 2004 when DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, set up a grand challenge. And instead of funding research groups for autonomous driving and giving individual awards, they decided to set up a prize and say $1 million for a first team to submit a car that could drive without any human intervention for 189 miles, I believe, in the desert. That was, at that time, GPS technology was still fairly new, so it required more than just GPS tracking in order to win. And so a lot of teams entered, and Carnegie Mellon's entry made it the furthest. I wasn't part of that team, but was more kind of advising students who were working in areas related to that. And then in 2000, so that challenge was renewed the following year. And in that one, there were three teams in particular that ended up winning and completing the entire race. And Stanford was the fastest, and then Carnegie Mellon had two other cars that finished second and third. And so Stanford took home the $1 million prize for the grand challenge. And then in 2007, they made a new challenge which said, now you know the car can follow a road by itself. Let's see if it can obey traffic laws and merge and obey traffic signals and avoid other cars. And so they set up a town that was in California that was set up as a kind of an obstacle course, and there were human drivers as well as other robot contestants operating at the same time. And in 2007, they had a $2 million prize that was awarded to Carnegie Mellon for getting the top entry that finished that race. And there were also, I think, four cars that completed the race entirely. So it was in the course of about 5 years, autonomous technology for automobiles, I think, had a big boost. And Google decided to strategically invest and try to see what it would take to take research technology and actually turn it into something productionizable that could change the world. There's a lot of, the average American spends, I think, about 48 minutes of their life every day commuting inside of a car. And if you could recover that somewhat by being able to do other activities during that time and then have the cars actually be much more safer. Also, a lot of accidents are traced back to human error. So if we could eliminate that, we could reduce the rate of accidents. It would be a big boon to the economy as well as much better in terms of reducing fatalities and injuries due to human error. So that was sort of the main motivation, to try and see if this technology could be productionized.
So when you started at Google, what were some of the problems that you had to solve just to get to a point where you could even build a prototype?
Yeah.
What were some of the problems that you had to solve, conceptually?
So the Google assembled a team of essentially some of the winners from Carnegie Mellon's team and Stanford's team. I wasn't directly involved with Carnegie Mellon's team, but more was hired to try and help implement their planning software. But what some of the big problems were, I think, perception and world modeling. How does a car actually understand what's around it? We take a lot of domain knowledge for granted. For example, the fact that if you saw a cardboard box in the road that looked like it was empty, would you swerve around it or would you run over it? And a lot of domain knowledge is needed in order to make that judgment call. And that's something I think is still a big challenge for robotics and for cars. But at the level that when we started the project, it was mostly, how do you tell the difference between a pedestrian, a static obstacle, something unexpected, and just staying in your lane and driving to the point where you can build an automated technology that was the safest, and actually was a big improvement over human driving. And that's, you know, that's a pretty tall order, because human drivers are amazingly adaptive and adept at being able to cope with a lot of uncertainty and to cope with changing situations. You know, you can repaint lines and roads, you can have flaggers, you know, you can have traffic diverted, and humans are able to adapt as long as and apply generalized rules of the road to a lot of unique situations, and drive where they've never driven before and still do it safely.
Well, you talk about the rules of the road. That was one of the first things you had to program into a car.
Yeah.
What, you know, what are you allowed to do? What are you supposed to do?
Yes.
So talk about some of what you did there. I mean, how the approach you took was first to sort of say, we're going to build a car that follows all the rules exactly. How did that go?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the interesting challenges is, and one of the conceptions that we had early on was that we could build a car that was the safest by being able to perfectly follow all the traffic rules. But as it turns out, being strictly following all of those rules may not actually be the safest way to drive. And what we learned over time is that driving like the median driver is actually the safest way to drive. In other words, people, depending on, and it's also region dependent, people have different, you know, local kind of conventions and things that is considered, you know, kosher practices on the road. But what we found is that being able to build a car that behaved like everyone else was actually the way to build the safest car. And because, you know, the intuitive explanation is that drivers are making decisions assuming that other drivers are going to behave normally. And the way they define normally is driving like the average or the median driver.
Driving like
that
everybody else.
Exactly. So, you know, that actually became the big challenge, is how do you make a system that can drive like everyone else? You know, Google has always been a company that has been good at handling big data and being able to also build world-class machine learning systems, and so being able to mine all that data and use it to build something that could model effectively in a computer the behaviors that humans took, you know, by collecting enough of that data and analyzing it and trying to build a system that followed all the rules but also did so in a way that drove like everyone else. And I think we were most proud of the fact that we were able to, you know, set this impossible challenge of driving these challenge routes all throughout California, around Lake Tahoe, through downtown San Francisco, all the way down Highway 1, and through Santa Monica up to Hollywood along Sunset Boulevard. Very challenging driving situations where you have to adapt and follow all the rules and do so the way everyone else does. We were most proud of the fact that people actually didn't notice, mostly, that there was a robot car driving alongside them. Because that's what our hope was, is that we would build a technology that would blend in, would be backwards compatible with the rest of the world, but also provide a level of safety and comfort and new autonomy that would change the game for automobiles.
Now, in addition to, you know, coming up with the algorithms that enable the car to make these kinds of decisions, you also need the car to get a whole ton of information in real time about what's going on around it. You have to be able to see and sense what's going on, and you had to make some advances there as well. Talk to me a little bit about what sorts of problems you had to solve to enable the car to get information about what's going on around it.
So the first version of our car, there's a couple of versions now, but the first version was built off of a Prius platform. So we weren't trying to build our own car, but we were building some custom hardware, firmware, and putting together some obviously custom software to drive sensing technologies. And the main sensing technologies that we had were cameras, radar, odometry, and GPS and accelerometers, as well as a new sensor that was developed right around the time when the Urban Challenge and Grand Challenges were happening, which is LIDAR, so time of flight lasers, that was able to, you know, and particularly a company called Velodyne produced a very nice sensor that is distinctive because it's the spinning laser that's very, very distinctive when you see it on top of the Google's car. It looks like a spinning KFC bucket. But that is able to measure about 1.2 million depth measurements per second, and being able to process all of that data and then build a spatial map of the world, identify and cluster and track other vehicles, pedestrians, motorcycles, and parked cars and other static obstacles, and then be able to really use that along with high-resolution maps in order to find out not only where the car is in the world so it doesn't get lost, but also have a sense of the positions and velocities of everything around it, and then use all that information and fuse it up into a behavior system that can make a plan for how the car needs to react in the next several milliseconds, and then have that loop keep running and updating. So, you know, in real time, the car is processing, you know, millions of pieces of information about the world and assembling that into a coherent map of what's happening around it, and then applying that that data so that it makes decisions about how the car should either accelerate, decelerate, or how the wheel should be turned, and that's sort of how it operates.
So, what sorts of things went wrong when you were testing? I mean, everything works great on paper, but when you get it out in the real world, you always find things that you didn't know were going to be a problem until you encounter it. What sorts of problems did you encounter, you know, as you were testing it?
Well, one of the things that was quite surprising was just how good, for example, humans are at seeing traffic lights from far away. Even at the resolution of the cameras that we had, there are some traffic lights that are fairly dim and very difficult to detect, and so that was a challenge early on. The other thing I think that was also quite challenging was that you know, the fact that not, you know, cars tend to do a surprising number of crazy things that you would never expect. For example, driving the wrong way down a one-way on-ramp. You know, you would say that, you know, it's common in computer science to say that, you know, writing a robust piece of software requires handling all corner cases. And what was really surprising was just how many corner cases there are, and making that software robust enough to handle it. It was very challenging. And I would say that's still probably the most difficult thing about trying to build any kind of autonomous system, any kind of robot, is robustly and gracefully handling all the possible ways that something unexpected could happen, and sort of doing the right thing in those cases.
I mean, the driverless car has been kind of making the rounds this past year or so. I mean, there was a demonstration of it in Austin a few months back. You know, one of the next challenges for Google is convincing state legislatures to update their traffic codes to allow for a car that doesn't actually have a driver operating it. You know, I mean, I know that you have moved on to other things, but, you know, sort of that, you know, from your perspective, you know, how should legislatures handle the idea of a driverless car? What's the right way to do that?
I think if you step back and you think about how automated technology has affected airplane travel, people have come to accept that an autopilot is able to safely handle and fly an airplane better than a human pilot, particularly in adverse weather conditions or high winds, zero visibility conditions. Clearly, you know, the autopilot is better. And I think when you think about how cars have changed just in the last 40 years with anti-lock brakes, power steering, now you have cruise control, you have a little bit of lane keeping, adaptive cruise control that does actually car in front of you following in lane keeping, you can think of the Google's technology as a natural extension of that to be able to handle more and more things, surface streets and roads, and essentially the legal framework which defined a licensed driver as operating solely a car. Now it evolved into a situation where you have both, you know, human judgment as well as machines building a technology that is safer. And so I think for states that are considering changing and allowing a legal framework to encompass cars that have more automated technology inside would be a good thing. It'll allow the United States in particular to take a leadership role in the technology by moving fast and providing a legal framework for this technology to flourish. Otherwise, it could develop in other countries. So I'm hoping, you know, that other states, along with California, Nevada, and Florida, will embrace this technology and change their laws to allow this technology to flourish in the United States.
Google would like to bring something to the market in the next, like, 5 years or so, which, from my perspective, is great. It's 7 years till my daughter gets a driver's license. A five-year window is awesome. But, you know, what do you envision happening with this? How do you see driverless cars changing society, changing the way, you know, we go about our daily lives? What you know, just give me your futurist vision.
Yeah. So, you know, I think, you know, Sebastian Thrun, who helped start this project, and Chris Urmson, who's the current tech lead, could offer maybe more insights on this. But from my perspective, I believe that this technology could provide three things. One, increased safety. It's clear that, you know, the accidents that are caused by human error could potentially be dramatically reduced by having this technology. I also think that it would allow an economic benefit, because a lot of people whose time is very important and productivity could be increased by recovering the time that they're spent sitting in traffic or stuck commuting. They could recover that time and hopefully use it more productively. And number three, it would actually allow for better cities with less congestion and less pollution, because it's very compatible with clean technology, batteries. You know, we chose for a reason cars with batteries so they could power the electronics that are needed for this. But we believe that, you know, by, you know, having computers that can react faster than a human could, you could essentially reduce the following distance there. So instead of adding a lane on the freeway, you could essentially increase the traffic density. And some estimates have said you could even double the traffic density just using existing infrastructure. So therefore, you could support a higher density of population in urban areas without expanding freeways and building more freeways, which I think would be a big win for society. It also could redesign the way people commute. Car sharing could be enabled. You essentially could have a valet service that could say, you know, my car, you know, instead of having it sit idle in a parking lot and fill up space and build more parking lots, we could just have the car drop us off at work and go back and run other errands or whatever while it's needed during the daytime, while I don't need it, and then come back and pick me up. I think there could be a lot of, essentially, land that could be reclaimed that's currently used as parking lots.
Okay. All right. James Cuthbert, thank you very much for talking to me about this. I'm looking forward to what the future brings with this kind of technology.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.